everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week we've got some great titles to chase away the January blues. Author and journalist Peter Ross discusses The Passions of Harry Bingo and discovers a fish and chip shop, Pavarotti.
Adina credine, te ne scondi or not, Saint Scorby. Small fish supper, please.
Ali Smith discusses pop art and politics in her Booker-nominated novel, Autumn. And the RNIB Connect Radio book group discusses Ali Smith's Autumn in their monthly meeting.
All across the country. Yeah.
That was my favourite chapter, I thought. That
really?
Vidar Harding reviews Stephen Fry's autobiography, Moab is My Washpot.
Don't worry, I said again. I'll look after you. Everything will be fine.
And author of Railhead, Philip Reeve, reveals the books of his life. That's all coming up in today's Read On. Peter Ross is an award-winning journalist and author with a wonderful eye for human interest stories. He's published two collections of his work, Dawnderlust and, most recently, The Passion of Harry Bingo. He writes with a great empathy, telling fascinating, insightful stories that would otherwise slip under the radar. He joined me down the line from our Glasgow studio. Peter Ross, welcome to Read On.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again.
In a world of fake news and division, it really is very refreshing to read journalism that celebrates the coming together of people in company and community to do something positive. Was that very much the focus of writing these stories?
I think I'm just very interested in people generally, and I do try to see the best in people, I think. I tend to write in quite a kind of positive way, although hopefully that doesn't mean that it's in some way kind of mealy-mouthed or anything like that. I am interested in kind of sort of celebrating people in all their kind of quirks and eccentricities and extraordinariness. You know, looking for the sort of extraordinary in the ordinary is what I try to do. That does take me into looking at different communities, whether it's in terms of, you know, folk rituals or that sort of thing. I'm quite drawn to these things because I think I'm probably myself quite a sort of solitary person, and I moved around a lot when I was growing up, so I've never really sort of experienced that sort of close-knit sense of kind of a community of people that have kind of known each other since they were children. But those are the sorts of things that certainly sort of draw me personally.
Well, it's very joyous and very non-judgmental. Mm. And what I love is the silliness.
It's interesting you use that word, kind of non-judgmental. I mean, that's certainly something that I want to try to do all the time. I really don't like the sort of journalism that kind of sneers at people. I want all the time, if I can, to have a lot of kind of humour in my stories. I think I'm probably essentially a comic writer, although there's a lot of sadness in the stories too, some of them. But I want that humour to sort of come from the people themselves and the things they say and do, rather than me sort of retrospectively making jokes and kind of laughing at them. You know, I think it's really important to kind of treat people on the page the way you would in real life, rather than, which I think happens a lot of time with stories, where people kind of are nice to people to their face and then they go away and write something maybe a bit sneery about them. It's something that I always want to try to avoid, even though I'm writing about people often in circumstances where it'd be very easy to kind of go away and sort of take the mickey out of them subsequently. I'm always very keen to avoid that.
And that really comes through in the title story, The Passion of Harry Bingo, who is a 97-year-old man who has supported Partick Thistle for all his life. And you describe it beautifully as he's passed this on to his granddaughter like an heirloom and a hereditary disease.
Yes, depending on how you look at it. I mean, the reason for writing that story was in part because I myself have never really felt a love of football in my bones. You know, I appreciate it, I like it well enough, but it's never really something that has sort of become important to me personally. And I sort of felt that as a sort of lack in myself, living in the west of Scotland where football is so much part of the culture. So that story was in a way an attempt at sort of trying to find sort of sage-like figures who could help me understand football and feel what they feel. And so I sought out Henry Calderhead, better known as Harry Bingle, who, as you say, had been going to see Partick Thistle since the end of the Second World War, and sort of spent time in his company and with his family at Firhill Partick Thistle's ground. Harry, actually, very sadly, has died since the publication of the book. He was 97, and fantastically, he was able to come along to the launch of the book and sort of see the book on its way out into life. At that launch, I read from the title story, The Passion of Harry Bingle. I wouldn't usually have read that story because it's quite long, so I only read part of it, and it's not one of the particularly funny ones, and I tend to read at these sort of public events, try to kind of focus on reading some that might give the audience a laugh. But I felt that with him there, it was good to sort of try to honour him in that way. And I think for the people that kind of came along to the launch, it was fantastic to actually be able to sort of to meet the man who that title story is about. I think that was quite a sort of special moment in a lot of ways. But no, he was a great guy, Harry. I think you know, people often talk about football as the beautiful game, and I think what they obviously mean by that is the sort of skills of the greatest players of it. But I think what really makes football beautiful is the place that it kind of has in the lives of those to whom it means a great deal. And in that sense, I hope I was able to kind of convey in that story the real beauty of football culture, and also I think the real beauty of kind of Harry Bingle's love for it.
Certainly in it, and also your story Herring Queens, you point something out. When you read it, seems obvious, but actually it hadn't really struck me before that these are expressions of identity in a post-industrial world where people don't have the togetherness of shared employment anymore. Supporting a football team or carrying out an annual gala or fair, it is a way of reconnecting with your neighbours.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, so that story you mentioned, Herring Queens, it's about, as you say, sort of local fairs or galas or fetes, which are things that happen throughout the summer in lots of parts of kind of lowland Scotland, sort of central belt Scotland, really. People will build floats out of lorries, or they'll, you know, construct sort of fairy tale castles in the front of their kind of council houses, and sort of elect, you know, kings and queens from the local children and this sort of thing. And these are events that don't really get very much attention from the press. I mean, other than in a kind of local press way, there'll be kind of photographs of it in the local papers, but the national papers would tend not to pay any mind to these things. Whereas I find them to be really very moving and important and significant. And part of their significance for me is, as you touch on there, what they've kind of come to mean in those communities. Because we're talking about places where at one time these towns would have grown up around particular employment. So they might be mining villages where the actual reason for their existence no longer exists because the pits closed or the factories closed and so on. But these expressions of kind of local identity and local pride, they persist, and they are what people base their identity around now, even though the actual work which once united them has gone. So I think there's a kind of joy to that, but also a kind of melancholy to it too, and that kind of mixture of emotion is something that I really find attractive and want to sort of try to feel and to understand, and then to try to kind of convey in my work. So that's definitely what kind of draws me to these things.
And there's definitely an elegiac feeling to many of your descriptions, but also the real joy and vibrancy of people's voices, which, especially in the audiobook version of Dawnderlust, which I've been enjoying, just come through incredibly strongly. Do you record the interviews?
What happens is, a lot of these stories, I should say, were written originally for newspapers, most of them were, and so they were written against very tight deadlines a lot of the time. So you would kind of go to the event, whatever it is, and then you'd have to write 1,600 words or more by 9 o'clock that evening, and they had to be pretty good, if possible. So in those circumstances, I probably wasn't doing a lot of recording because I didn't have time to transcribe it. in a situation where I'm sitting down and doing a one-to-one interview with someone over a period of time, I'll record that because I can then transcribe the interview. But a lot of these were done with a notebook and pen, you know, so I would kind of write down phrases that I heard people say or certain things that they said to me, and I would just try and kind of catch exactly what they said as they said it, because I think it's really important that the quotation in these stories is very often in Scots, and also the type of Scots it's in will vary depending on where the person is from. So I'm trying to write down really what the person said exactly. I'm not trying to translate their words into standard English, because I think that isn't to tell the truth. I think you're essentially changing what they said if you do that. And also a lot of the time I find Scots language actually makes anything that's funny funnier, and anything that's sad, sadder. You know, it's a kind of emotional intensifier. So I really wanted to kind of have the words as true as they said them. I wanted to let the readers kind of hear what I heard. And you mentioned the audiobook there of Donderlust, which was read by Robbie Coltrane. And Robbie Coltrane really did that essentially as a favour to me, because he really liked the book and my work generally. So he was willing to kind of come and read the audiobook. And we spent a kind of week together recording that in Glasgow. And what was brilliant about getting him to do it, and why I can't really imagine many other people who could have done it as well, is that he's got such a kind of facility for voices. You know, he's almost an impressionist in some way, so he can kind of get the different accents and things. But he's also able to kind of, as an actor, kind of convey the emotional resonances, you know, the kind of funniness. He can make the people that listen to it really feel it, I think, which is why it was sort of wonderful to have him come and do the book. But yeah, certainly having the way people speak truly conveyed is important to me.
My first question is about his forthcoming debut single, a spoof of the Go Compare adverts. His reply lasts 28 minutes and takes in topics including Catholicism, prejudice against fat people, Robert Burns, Scottish independence, Islamic terrorism, Roman theology, Victorian architecture. How can you not think of God when you look at the fourth bridge? And inevitably, the price of fish. He also gives me a song, the first of a few I'll hear over the next hours. Corvi performs part of Gaetano Donizetti's 1832 opera L'Elisir d'Amore. As he sings, he closes his eyes, a thumb and finger pinched together, his left hand moving gently through air heavy with hot oil. All the while, the business of the shop continues, the sound of customers ordering and being served mingling with that of the love song. The total effect is that of a pathetic duet.
Adina credine, te ne scondi or no,
sings Corby.
Small fish supper, please. Non appeal passarlo, te ne asci oro. Gisling salt and vinegar.
Robbie Coltrane reading Dawnderlust, which was written by my guest Peter Ross. So, Luigi Corvi sounds like a fantastic character.
Yeah, I mean, Luigi Corvi, who is this 25-stone opera-singing chip shop owner, is the very embodiment of the idea that you couldn't make it up, you know? I mean, I could not create that person as a fictional character. You know, he lives, he breathes, he's in Glasgow. You could go out now and buy a bag of chips from him. And that's the fantastic thing about this, you know. These people are all real. They're just there waiting to be discovered, essentially. And it's, as I said earlier, it's what I really want, is to find and discover the extraordinary in the everyday and to celebrate it. And so, you know, I spent a day with Luigi Corvi in his fish and chip shop, Val d'Oro, and I heard him sing, and, you know, it was just absolutely wonderful. And I think we actually left that. That was the last of the stories to be recorded for the audiobook, because I think Robbie wasn't too sure about how to sing the opera, but I think he did a pretty good job in the end.
So do you have a favourite story from either of the collections?
From Donderlust, I think I probably especially like the story about memorials on park benches, which is to say that it's about, you know, when you go into a public park and you see there's a little plaque on the back of it and it's for so-and-so who loved this place, that kind of thing. I've always been very interested in those and the stories behind them. And so I kind of set out to try and tell the stories behind some of those that I discovered in Princes Street Gardens in Edinburgh and also in the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh. So I found out who the people were behind the plaques, and I spoke to their loved ones about who those people were and sort of tried to tell that story. And I think I like that one because it's got that, it hits that kind of sweet spot of being very moving and often entertaining. But also, it was just incredibly difficult to do. So just on a kind of point of view of kind of journalistic endeavour, I was pleased that it worked out because I had to choose the particular memorials carefully, and then I had to write to the council to ask them to pass on my letters to, you know, so actually finding the people was really, really hard. And so just from the point of view that it actually happened and worked out successfully, I think that's my favourite in that story. In The Passion of Harry Bingo, I think my favourite story is probably The Waligo Steps, which is one about these steps that have been cut into a cliff face up in Caithness that fisherwomen at one time would have sort of climbed up and down with baskets full of herring to sell from the sort of 18th century onwards for about 100 years or so. And it's also a story which is more generally about the kind of memorials that we leave behind in the landscape. And it's got a great character in it called Davy Nicholson, who's the man that looks after the steps. So it's a great celebration of Davy, but also it's a story that kind of ponders on the human condition a bit, and also quite a personal story. I put myself in that story and my own sort of family background and sort of sadnesses in my own life in a way that I haven't really in other stories. So it's quite a new approach for me, and I think and hope that it worked out quite well. I think that's my favourite piece, probably.
That summer day was the start of it. Walking in Greenbank Gardens, a National Trust property just to the south of Glasgow, a small silver plaque on a bench caught my eye. Muriel Broadbent, Muriel Lowe. Oh, what a wonderful girl to know. 1914 to 1983. Such an elegant little memorial, love garbed as wit, and it was easy to imagine Mr. Broadbent, a proper old gent, never without his trilby, according to the head gardener, visiting this beautiful spot and thinking of his late wife, whose maiden name had been Lowe, and whom one could almost see, thanks to the plaque, in her own youthful bloom.
Robbie Coltrane reading from Dawnderlust, a collection of stories written by my guest, Peter Ross. It's available in print, audiobook and ebook formats. The Passions of Harry Bingo is out now in print and ebook, and let's hope there's an audiobook version soon.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away, with practical and emotional support, so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away, from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you, on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
This is an RNIB talking book.
A clip from Richard Baker's book, Here Is the News, recorded in 1967.
Much less frustrating is the experience of reading books for the blind. I'm one of a team of actors and broadcasters who make this one of their spare time occupations. In the tiny studio in Great Portland Street, we read for hours at a stretch into a microphone. The only visible audience, the sound engineer. The daughter of a blind lady of 80 wrote to me. The talking book machine, she said, has brought a renewal of joy and interest into her life, which is hard to describe. My mother sends her most warm thanks for bringing her so much pleasure and encouragement. Such a letter is immensely rewarding.
For more information on the Talking Book service, head to www.rnib.org.uk or call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's compendium of the best in books. Still to come in today's show, Vidar Hardeng discusses Moab Is My Washpot by Stephen Fry, and Philip Reeve brings us the books of his life. But first, author Ali Smith. Her novel Autumn was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. It's the first in a planned quartet of novels, each of which will use one of the seasons as its background. Autumn is set in 2016. Daniel is a century old and reflecting on his life. Elizabeth, born in 1984, has a wary eye on the future, and the United Kingdom seems more divided than ever by that summer's EU referendum. Ali Smith joined me in the RNIB Connect radio studio to tell me more. So, Ali Smith, welcome to Read On.
Thank you, Red. I'm so glad to be here.
Autumn, obviously, is very much the season of great changes, and central to the book Autumn is the post-Brexit feeling in the UK. Did you feel compelled to write the book?
I've been thinking about writing these books. There are going to be four books, all named just simply after the seasons, and I now know for sure I've been thinking about them for about 20 years. But I always thought I would do them when I was really, really old, which of course means I'm probably really old now. I don't know how these things come on us. Anyway, the reason I went with it is because I had discovered in the novel before writing this one that publishers could produce a book in its finished form very, very fast, and that the long time you usually have to wait for a manuscript to turn into a book isn't necessary. So I said to my publishers, well, that's really exciting. That's like when the Victorian novelists wrote their novels. They wrote them on the hop, as it were. They wrote them, you know, kind of racing ahead of themselves. They published them as they wrote them. How about if we tried to write something that was really contemporary, published it right up against the time about which it is, a time about which it's written, and is that possible? And they said, OK, we'll give it a go. So I started writing it, and then the Brexit process, as it were, started to happen, and then I realised that maybe books are more mysterious than we think, and that they, you know, they have their own demands on us that we don't know they're going to make until we actually start writing them. So I went with it, and I wrote the time as the time was happening. And that's how this book has come about. And the other three coming after it will also be, to some extent, contemporary in the same vein, with any luck. And, of course, the thing about the novel, as a form anyway, is that it's really about time and how time passes. And the thing about the seasons is that they remind us that time isn't just one day to the next, it's cyclic. It goes around in big circles inside us. So we remember all the autumns when we encounter in autumn. So it was an interesting experience to know that we were right up against the, what should we call it, the glass ceiling of Brexit, and everything was about to shatter into what? Who knows? And at the same time, you've got this sense of dimension about the dimension of time, the longness, the profundity of time, the depth of time, as well as the surface on which we all live.
And certainly that was a touchstone I kept coming back to in some of the darker moments of the novel, and there are some very dark reflections on the division that has been caused by Brexit. There are lots of metaphors of division and lots of images of division within the book, and yet there's also a lot of humour, and a lot of that humour plays with the fact that this is a cyclical process, that the world will not end just because of the Brexit vote. I found myself laughing and gasping at the same time.
That's lovely. I like that description of the book. I like it because it has hope at its core, as time does, because time does pass. And with any luck, it's also uncompromising enough to be truthful to the very difficult things that Brexit hasn't just caused, but has revealed in the country, the divides, the divisions, not just in this country, but the divides and divisions that we now know are worldwide, you know, and that have been there for all the years and not been attended to. And so Brexit, in a way, is just, it's like the revelation of it. Mm. The book I began to write before we were sure the Brexit process was happening was already full of questions about the mass movement of people across the world, how we relive, you know, how we live in a world which is shifting so fundamentally, and how we do this in a humane way it was always, I think, at the basis of this novel, this story. But really, really, at the basis of it is dialogue, talking to people that you don't know. And, you know, the life that comes from dialogue, from talking to someone else, from multilogue, from the conversations that form us as people and that teach us as people and that allow us to know how alive we are.
And actually in the book you do use the expression the end of dialogue, and then in the next sentence talk about democracy having become like a broken bottle that you can threaten somebody with. I wondered, in amongst the lists that you have there, the Google search type of language that bubbles up through some of the narrative, if you feel that people have got too much choice, they're endlessly looking for an answer, and so they go for a knee-jerk response and become absolutist one way or the other.
Oh, I think we're living in times that are asking us to be binary, that ask us to tick a box to suggest who we are, you know, to hold up a passport, and this is supposed to mean us. This little piece of, you know, this little set of pieces of paper in a little cover means us. Mm. Well, we are human. We are multivalent. We are layered. We are fascinating. We are not what we see on a screen or what we live with on a surface. We are dimensional, and I think that the use of language generally reminds us to be dimensional wherever we encounter it, in whatever form, because it asks us to think about meaning. So we just have to look twice or three times or whatever it is that language is doing, and we know where we are with what language is asking of us, or what the uses of language are that are being foisted upon us or offered to us. And that's why, in a way, the literary project is so important, because the novel as a form has always been about newness and about how we live and society, all those things, and about time and about the time in which we live. So if we look to the novel, we'll remind ourselves of our own dimension.
And you do something very novel with this book that I hadn't come across before. The third character in the book is Pauline Boaty, who's a real-life character who was the female pop artist, the only female pop artist in the UK in the 1960s. And you describe beautifully her art, for which I'm very grateful. I can't see it, and to have it described for me is wonderful. But actually, I suddenly realised that your book is also a collage, a montage of what you've seen around you, of your reflection of the debate over Brexit and how people are approaching it. And I suddenly saw it as a picture rather than the book.
Oh, that's a lovely, I love you talking about my book. Please always be the person who talks about my book on the air.
You carry on writing them.
because Pauline Boaty, as you say, a real life person who died very young. She died at the age of 28 in the mid-60s, 1966. She was not only the pretty much one and only female pop artist that we have had in this country. She was also a kind of beautiful force of energy and of dynamism and of excitement and of articulacy. Really early on in the changes that were coming through the 60s, Boaty was one of the speakers and the visions of what was possible for us all, but particularly for women at this point in juncture. And one of the things she did was respond with all her thought, heart and spirit to the contemporary. And so her work is full of contemporary reference, and collage which holds together missiles and Kennedy and Elvis and Marilyn and the Beatles and Fellini and the things which were happening all around her at the time that were becoming famous because of the way in which the images of them were being proliferated. And what Boti does, it's so brilliantly simple. She addresses the image, she repaints, reimagines the image that we think we've seen a thousand, a million times, or we've heard about and we think we understand and we know. She reimagined it and she re-presented it. Now, one of the joys of what you've just said to me about the workings of this book is that actually none of us can see any of Boti's work because none of it's publicly available to see at all. So the descriptions of them, the notion that that's a gift of Boti to out into the world is just, I think, that's a lovely thing. It's kind of filled my heart with, yeah, that was good, that was right. To me, it's a crime that we don't have her work available. Her work exists in private collections, and there's one that exists at the Tate, which has now been, it was out for a while at Liverpool and has just been put back into storage. And it is the most spine-tinglingly beautiful thing to see and to be near or to have described to you, and I wish it was more available, but here we go, that's good. There's a payoff to this book, which is that we're making those pictures available in all the ways.
And you are bringing to people's attention that it is perfectly possible to hold oppositional images, thoughts in balance with each other and judge them objectively in a world of rather subjective judgment that we live at the moment.
In being battered as we are with information, it is possible to stop and take stock. It's as simple as that. And it really is simple, and it really does need us to draw up a moment and just think, OK, now I know that's possible to do that. And with any luck, that this book also signals that that action.
Well, no, I certainly you've introduced me to a figure who I hope to hear an awful lot more about. Mm-hmm. And let's hope, well, if there is an exhibition of her work, would you come around and be my audio descriptor, please?
Oh, I so would do that. I would do it with joy. I would love to do that.
In the meantime, obviously, many of your books have been made into talking books and are available from the Talking Books Library. You've been quite instrumental in making sure that's happened and been to the studio before to hear them being recorded. Is it something that's close to your heart?
It is close to my heart. I am a fan of all the ways that there are to read in the world. And there are many, many ways to read in the world. And Talking Books is one of the most exciting ways to read because it goes direct to voice. And there's nothing more important in any story than voice. So the notion that a voice can simply be there in your ear telling you the story as it happens is to me a form of magic. And I love it.
Let's hear what the R&IB Connect Radio book group made of Ali Smith's Autumn.
I actually do like stories that aren't linear. I quite like stories that move backwards and forwards in time. It, you know, makes me think a bit, I think. But I do have a few kind of grumbles about it. I asked my sister to read it in print. Me and my sister often read the same books at the same time. I listen, she reads. And I was thinking about the structure because both she and I, we like the same kind of books, and we were both English teachers. So we look at the actual writing style. And I thought it was a bit pretentious in places. And she agreed with me. I didn't tell her first. I wanted her to read it and get back to me. She's trying to echo Dickens when she does all the repetition. You know, she does a whole chapter where she's saying, and this happened, and this happened.
All across the country.
Across the country. Yeah.
I thought that was my favourite chapter. I thought that
really? That is definitely, you know, she's taking off Dickens, and I just thought that was a little bit constructed and pretentious. And even some of the poetry, she's obviously a big fan of Keats. And so I think she's trying a little bit too hard at times with the actual style.
All across the country, people felt it was the wrong thing. All across the country, people felt it was the right thing. All across the country, people felt they'd really lost. All across the country, people felt they'd really won. All across the country, people felt they'd done the right thing and other people had done the wrong thing. All across the country, people looked up Google, what is EU? All across the country, people looked up Google, move to Scotland.
Also, I think it's the kind of book that's going to end up being studied and deconstructed by students, probably university students, because of all the symbolism in it and the unusual style. And it reminded me, I don't know if anybody else remembers this book because it is going back. It reminded me of Angela Carter's Nights at the Circus, which was a book that I did when I was doing my English degree. And it was a similar kind of something really different and a similar kind of plot style, you know, that moved about and all the symbolism. And it was very, very unusual. When I read that first, I didn't like it. But because I was studying it, I had to keep going back to it. And I ended up absolutely loving the book once I looked into it. And I think this book will be like that. It'll definitely be on the syllabus. But I don't think I'm with Alan. I'm not going to read the next one, Winter. It didn't really grab me enough to want to read the whole quartet. And the thing about falling asleep, I think the reader had a lovely, gentle voice, which, again, when they were doing the poetic bits, it did make you nod off. I had to listen to it during the day because I couldn't keep awake.
The lady called Melody Grove.
Yeah, it was Melody, yes.
Well,
yeah.
I'd love to hear, I thought she read it beautifully. And
she
I'd
did.
Love to hear her reading Bronte or Jane Austen, any of those sort of 19th century or even Dickens. I think she would read tremendously well. I mean, I absolutely love Dickens, and I think she would read those authors really well.
I thought she read it very well because I don't think it was necessarily an easy book to read.
No, I don't think it was.
But she did have quite a soporific voice, I felt, and I had to really listen to it during the day because, as I say, it put me to sleep. I had to stop reading it, a book that I was in the middle of, to read this one, and I'm dying to get back to it because it was a really fabulous book. It was quite difficult to get back from it's a fantasy one. It was quite difficult to get back from that to sort of present day.
Just the kind of conversation that makes joining a book group so worthwhile. A reminder that Autumn is available in Braille, giant print, and as a talking book from the RNIB library. And if you'd like to get involved in your own telephone book group, here's how.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
As we've just heard, sight loss need be no barrier to enjoying a good book. But not everyone has the time or inclination to join a book group. A growing number of blind and partially sighted book lovers are sharing their recommendations via blogs and newsletters. Here at Read On, we're always keen to hear your thoughts on what you've been reading. You can do so by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Blind book reviewer and RNIB Connect community member Vidar Harding wanted to tell us about Stephen Fry's autobiography, Moab Is My Washpot, so came into the studio to discuss it with our producer, Robert Kirkwood.
I was a new boy last term, I said, a huge and perfectly inexplicable surge of satisfaction filling me all the way from gartered woolen socks to blue-banded boater. It really isn't so bad, you know, though I expect you feel a bit scared and a bit homesick. It didn't quite dare look at me, but nodded again and gazed miserably down at shiny black Cambridge shoes, which seemed to me to be as small as a baby's booties. Everybody cries. You mustn't feel bad about it. It was at this point that it announced itself to be Samuel Anthony Farlow Bunce, and to its friends, Sam, but never Sammy. I shall have to call you Bunce, I told him, and you will call me Fry. You'll call me Fry S.J. if my bro is about, so there won't be any mix-up. Not Fry Minor or Fry the Younger, I don't like that. Here, I've got a spare hanky. Why didn't you blow your nose? There'll be others along in a minute. Others? He looked up from emptying himself into my hanky, like a baby deer hearing a twig snap by a water pool, and cast his eyes about him in panic. Just other train boys. There are usually about 20 of us. You see that piece of paper stuck to the window? Reserved for Stouts Hill School, it says. We've got this whole carriage to ourselves, 4 compartments.
Well, I have to say that I think Stephen Fry is arguably one of our best-known voices. He's terrific with words, both in spoken form and, if anyone reads this book, in written form. A thoroughly absorbing and very open, very honest, disarmingly honest autobiography. It's a real warts-and-all account of his early life and into early adulthood. I'm not sure what people would expect from an autobiography. Some are more circumspect than others, but I don't think Stephen Fry shies away from telling it as it is in how he saw it. And it's very much, you know, a story about a young lad sent off to boarding school at an early age. It talks about the relationship he has with his family, his sister and brother. His exploits at school didn't necessarily have the most happy, shall we say, of childhood. Constantly in trouble for all sorts of minor and more serious misdemeanours, both at prep school and then beyond, I think at Uppingham. And then as we get into sort of adolescence and early adulthood, there's the whole sort of sexuality agenda, and he doesn't shy away from talking about homosexuality, and also his stint in prison as well. And I think he's to be admired, without being patronising, for his candour, for his honesty, and frankly for the beautiful use of language in which he tells his own very personal story.
It was actually the reading it, there really is a dark side to Stephen Fry, or there was when he was a younger boy. I mean, it is full of stealing, there's cheating,
absolutely,
there's lying.
Yeah, anyone who now sees him on whatever programme it is, on television, or listens to him on radio, whether it's I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue or whatever it happens to be, if you hadn't read the book, you wouldn't have a clue that this guy did have, as you describe it, Robert, a darker side in his early times, and certainly was battling with what some might regard as, you know, those sort of demons. Yes, he was into theft and all sorts of dishonesty at the time, and I think it has to be someone who's a, you know, got an admirable degree of honesty and candour, who can actually talk about that, and who can be so open and share all of that with an admiring public. Because if you're in the public eye, you might lose a lot of admiration if you're somebody who's on a bit of a pedestal and you know, whose talents are appreciated across the board. And I think it's fair to say his have been over a number of years. And I think this very revealing account of his early life and his growing up will actually perhaps surprise a lot of people, but because it is so honest, I think he'll get a lot of approval, I suppose, for want of a better word, for actually putting it down on paper, or in this sense audio form. Again, I make this point quite a lot when talking about people writing their memoirs or their own autobiographies. They often benefit from the individual reading it. Now, Stephen Fry has got a great voice. Anyone familiar with those Harry Potter novels will be, I think, agree that frankly he did them superb justice. Here he is reading his own story, and again he's got a very immediately recognisable, distinctive, rich voice, and it certainly keeps you going for quite a number of CDs, 10 or 11 I think from memory. It is not a superficial book in any way, and Robert, I'm going to turn the tables on you now and talk about the title of the book, because in fact it might strike people as rather odd, mightn't it?
Well, it's never actually explained in the actual text of the book, but it's a verse found in Psalm 60 and I think and in Psalm 108. Now, it doesn't explain, it tells you what Moab is my washpot means, but it doesn't explain why it was used as the title for this autobiography. It says, and I am quoting Wikipedia, so please forgive me, citation may be needed. Jews in ancient times were extremely concerned with cleanliness. Whilst wearing sandals in the dusty desert environment, their feet would become filthy, and upon entering a home they would be washed with water. They would not put their feet into bowls, but instead hold their feet over the bowl and pour clean water over them, and the bowl would be used to catch the water. Moab, which had threatened Israel, was to be so completely subdued, and so became likened to a washpot or basin. So there you go.
Intriguing stuff. Well, if nothing else, it is memorable, if only because it is such an unusual title for any autobiography, and it certainly does stick in the mind. So clever ploy, clever use of that particular expression, and thank you for going into the detail.
Now, what actually this book does, it covers the same ground as Stephen Fry's first novel, The Liar, where a schoolboy falls in love with another schoolboy. And that was another thing that I think I may have missed by reading the print version of this book, because someone has told me the audio version of it, when the 14-year-old Stephen Fry becomes besotted with the 13-year-old, well, he's called Matthew Osborne in the book, but we know that that's not his real name, that's a pseudonym. They say it's an almost perfect description of love.
I think it's certainly, yeah, I think, just thinking back to that particular section of the book, it is again, coming back to what I was saying about the use of language and the clever literary skills that Stephen Fry undoubtedly has, I think that's probably a very fair description of what can often be a very clumsy description for some people to write, or some people might shy away from it for whatever reason. But no, I think what you said there, Robert, rings true.
What happens when we get there? What do you mean? When we get to the station? Oh, there'll be a bus to meet us, don't worry. I'll make sure you aren't lost. How old are you?
I'm 7 and a half.
He looked much younger. Nappy age, he looked.
Don't worry, I said again. I'll look after you. Everything will be fine.
I'll look after you. The pleasure of saying those words, the warm, wet sea of pleasure. Quite extraordinary. A little pet all to myself.
We'll be friends, I said. It won't be nearly as bad as you expect. You'll see.
Kindly paternal thoughts hummed in my mind as I tried to imagine every worry that might be churning him up. All I had to do was remember my own dreads of the term before.
Everyone's very nice, really.
Matron unpacks for you, but you've got to take your games clothes down to the bagroom yourself, so you'll have to know your school number so as you can find the right peg. My number's 104, which is the highest number in the school's history, but 12 boys left last term, and there are only 8 or 9 new boys, so there probably won't ever be a 105. I'm an otter. Someone will probably tell you what house you're in. You should watch out for Hampton. He gives Chinese burns and dead legs. If Mr. Kemp is on duty, he gives bacon slices. It's soccer this term, my bro says. I hate soccer, but it's Conkers as well, which is supposed to be really good fun. My bro says everyone goes crazy at Conker time. Conkers bonkers, my bro says.
I think it's probably one of the most candid autobiographies I've ever listened to. It's beautifully written. It's disarmingly honest. I think you've got to read it with a relatively open mind in many cases. But I think, you know, full marks for somebody who's really gone to town to actually produce what seems to be a thoroughly honest, thoroughly informative and thoroughly compelling life story.
And Moab is My Washpot is available from the RNIB Library in Braille and as TB 11490. And don't forget, if, like Vidar, you'd like to share the thoughts about a book that you've read, you can do so by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. One of my favourite reads last year was Philip Reeve's brilliant steampunk fantasy, Railhead. The first book in a trilogy, It imagines a future universe ruled by search engines and crisscrossed by steam engines, in which human guile is pitted against artificial intelligence. You can hear the full interview by searching for Philip Reeve on our Audio Boom page. But for now, here he is sharing the books of his life. So, was there a book that you read as a younger person that made you want to become a writer?
Yes, there were a whole bunch, really. I think from quite an early age I was very taken with books, and whatever I was reading made me want to write. So I was hugely influenced by C.S. Lewis, the Narnia books, when I was about 7 or 8. And then when I was about 9 or 10, Tolkien took over and The Lord of the Rings. Those were very important books to me because they sort of showed me that you could invent your own world to tell a story in, which is basically what I do for a living now. But I think a favourite author of mine, who I still go back to and read sometimes, is Rosemary Sutcliffe, who maybe isn't as well known nowadays as the other two are. Although she was a very big children's author at the time and is still highly regarded. She's very much the children's author that children's authors hold as a favourite. And Rosemary Sutcliffe wrote basically historical novels about sort of Roman and early medieval Britain, and usually from the point of view of a young person, generally a young man, setting out in life, having adventures.
Blood Feud by Rosemary Sutcliffe. Alexia always brings the candles a little too soon. Maybe she is afraid that I shall be trying to work without enough light to see by. Maybe she is afraid that in the dusk I shall start remembering and grow home-hungry. It is true that dusk is a good time for remembering, and of all times a spring twilight is apt to turn the heart homeward. And I do remember so many things. Small, unimportant things. Gorse, honey-scented along the headlands, and the crash and cream of the long sea rollers beating on the jagged western coast. Curlew, crying over the high moors. The smell of a newborn calf brought in from the herd.
And is there a book that, on a rainy day, you'd like to curl up with and reread on a sofa?
Yes, if I'm very bored or I can't sleep at night or I'm in hospital or something, what I tend to reach for is P.G. Wodehouse very often. The Jeeves and Worcester books are very light and just very beautifully written. And they're almost all exactly the same. In most of them, young Bertie Worcester has to, for some reason or other, go as an impostor into some rich aunt or uncle or relative's country house, and all kinds of farcical goings-on ensue. And he's guided through this process by his unflappable manservant, Jeeves. And the writing is just beautiful. Wodehouse was a master of English prose. And the characterization is good. The story is told by Bertie Worcester, who's this sort of upper-class 1920s twit, but a very engaging one and a surprisingly good storyteller. Strangely, we were talking earlier about my novel Railhead, which is a kind of a cyberpunky, futuristic thriller. And I had been reading, when I was writing that, I had been reading a lot of P.G. Wodehouse to my son, who, to my surprise, loved them when he was sort of 9 or 10. And I kind of realized halfway through Railhead that my hero was going in disguise aboard the Emperor's train, and that his unflappable robot companion was down in the servants' quarters giving him instructions. And I kind of realized I was basically rewriting P.G. Wodehouse. So not only is it my favorite curling up with on a rainy day book, it was strangely influential.
That's wonderful. I think that's rather a nice little exclusive for us.
Oh,
thank you very much.
Should I recommend a particular one, actually?
Yes, yeah. Please.
There are loads of Jeeves and Worcester books. My favourites are the short stories. I think they work very well in short story form. But of the novels, the best one is called The Code of the Worcesters, which is just a superb little... It's a comedy machine, basically. It's just perfectly structured, and everything works, and all the jokes pay off in the right places, and I would recommend it to anyone, I think.
Go
Good evening, Jeeves.
Good morning, sir. This surprised me.
Is it morning?
Yes, sir.
Are you sure? It seems very dark outside.
There is a fog, sir. If you will recollect, we are now in autumn, season of mist and mellow fruitfulness.
Season of what?
Mist, sir, and mellow fruitfulness.
Yes, yes, I see. Well, be that as it may, get me one of those braces of yours, will you?
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yes, one of my favourite authors is Geraldine McCaughrane, who she wrote some very fine adult novels back in the 90s, but she's basically known as a children's writer, and a very, very fine one indeed. And I always go straight to her new books when they're published, and she's just released one called Where the World Ends, which is set in the 1700s, and it's about a boatload of boys from the island of St. Kilda who are taken out to live on a sea stack, this tiny little rocky island way offshore, out in the middle of the ocean somewhere, to collect birds and birds' eggs to get the St. Kildans through the winter. And this is a thing that happens every year, and they're left there for about a fortnight, and then the boat comes and picks them up. But on this particular year, the boat doesn't return, and they wait and they wait, and they end up having to spend the whole winter on this sea stack, and they don't know why the boat hasn't come back, they don't know what's happened. And it doesn't sound like much fun, you know, it sounds rather a bleak, grim sort of a book. But Geraldine McCaughrane is such a fine writer, and such a good and wise person, I think. She's just able to turn these things into the most wonderful story, and it is bleak and it is grim, and it's also funny and exciting and inspiring. It's a wonderful book.
Philip Reeve, thank you so much for sharing your obvious love of reading with us and for being a guest on Read On Air.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Philip Reeve. His book Railhead is available in Braille, giant print and as TB23956. And if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us a line via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or just search for RNIB Radio. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.